and welcome to Batflips and Nerds, the podcast that offers a British take on baseball. In this week, where Clayton Kershaw cried. Joining me this week to talk the week in baseball and discuss some interesting and current parallels between baseball and the UK's national pastime football is the president of the Royal Air Force's John Farrell fan club, Tom Pringle. How are you, Tom?
I'm good, mate. How are you? Thanks for that. I completely missed Clayton Kershaw crying. I've been away all week, so hopefully you're going to tell me about that.
Yeah, I am going to tell you all about that in a minute. We can probably start there. This week in baseball is the week that Clayton Kershaw cried. And the reason that Kershaw cried, and I'm not sure if you've been away for a week, you might have missed this absolutely, was that the big story of the waiver trade deadline was the Dodgers trading away AJ Ellis for the Phillies' Carlos Ruiz. So two catchers of yesteryear, two stand-up backup catchers of the present, the World Series winning Phillies catcher Carlos Ruiz traded for Clayton Kershaw's personal catcher AJ Ellis, and according to all reports, Clayton Kershaw cried.
Oh dear. So,
how do you feel about that? That breakup of that that modern bromance?
Well, I've always been suspect of personal catchers, especially when you think of David Ross and how terrible he is as a hitter, being the personal catcher of John Lester. But I'm guessing the Dodgers just want hitting. Do you know what? I've not even looked at Ruiz's stats this year. Is he better than Ellis? I'm guessing he is, because Ellis is...
His OPS against lefties is about 300 points better than Ellis. Yeah, and I think that it's a lefty-heavy division, particularly with the Giants, with Bumgarner and Moore certainly starting to roll out there and out west. So I think that was the rationale behind it. Yeah. Nevertheless, it's a sad day when AJ Ellis isn't crouching down behind the plate to catch that greatest curveball you've ever seen.
No, exactly. And whenever Kershaw's crying, then baseball should cry, because he is baseball. He's awesome.
He absolutely is. So that that is the big story this week. It's been pretty quiet after our last podcast where we. We're able to talk about A-Rod, Prince Fielder, Ichiro, and the glorious comedy sideshow that is Tim Tebow. This has been a rather quieter week in terms of stories, but a couple of interesting things that I thought we could touch on. It's the waiver deadline on Wednesday. We're recording this on Sunday. There's not been a lot yet. Ellis for Ruiz being certainly the biggest splash and the oddest of trades, but there's been one or two other interesting ones. Oakland traded Mark Rutschinski, which I probably haven't pronounced correctly, for Max Schrock, who, if Darius were here with us today, we would probably learn more about Max Schrock, because he's big on his prospects. But apparently, a big win for Oakland in that trade. And the other one was that the Braves managed to trade Jeff Francoeur for someone with a pulse, which I think is perhaps the most surprising trade of the week.
I'm going to have to look that up. I don't even know what happened. Again, because I've spent a whole week away, I've just sort of dipped into scores and that's about it. I'm going to look that up, though, while you're telling me some more about it.
Yeah, I don't think it was much. I think it was some chump change from the Miami Marlins, but the notion that Jeff Francoeur was going to get traded for anything other than a set of uniforms, two deflated basketballs, and a dead squirrel was quite a surprise to me. And I think it was. I did a poll on the Twitter feed earlier this week as to what was the most bizarre trade, and I fully expected Ellis for Ruiz to be way out in front, but the Jeff Francoeur for anything was a clear winner in terms of the public on the Batflips and Nerds Twitter feed this week.
Yeah, well, it looks like they got minor league infielder Dylan Moore from the Rangers and minor league catcher Matt Foley from the Marlins, whilst also sending cash to Miami.
Yeah, apparently Matt Foley, I didn't look this up to cross-check it, but apparently he's a 35-year-old minor league battery catcher. So it was, when I say that they got something for Jeff Francoeur, I really do mean that in terms of the sort of slightest of definitions. Yeah. But nevertheless, an interesting one. A couple of other fun asides from yesterday evening that I just wanted to get your take on. Jason Hammel pulled after 2.1 innings and 39 pitches of the Cubs' 3-2 loss to the Dodgers, and apparently was absolutely furious. He wasn't injured. He thought he was pitching relatively well. But so my take on this was, this is just more evidence that Joe Maddon is a cretin. I don't know if you have a more nuanced take than that.
I don't know, really. I suppose with him being ex-Tampa Bay Rays, then we have to just dislike him straight away. But is there nothing from it then at all? No injury, no strain?
Nothing. And Hamill, I read the comments because I looked through the scores this morning and thought it was a strange one in the box, given that Hamill's been pitching so well this season. But no, he was on record as being, and that was the word he used, absolutely furious to be pulled after 39 pitches and 2.1 innings. But it seems like crazy. I mean, I know that Maddon's got a bit of a reputation for doing some slightly wacky and out there things, but that one just seems beyond the pale.
Yeah, that's bizarre. It's not like his place was coming up in the batting lineup either, looking at it.
No.
2.1 innings, that's bizarre.
Yeah, so
like you say, that is Joe Maddon all over, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, look at me and my little beard and my funny glasses. Aren't I hilarious? Yeah. It kind of makes me root against the Cubs a little bit. Everything, there's so much to like about that brilliant team of young players and really good pitchers to watch, apart from Jake Arrieta. And then you've got that plonker sat in the dugout.
Do you think, though, any team that has had a drought like the Cubs, or any team that's not playing well for a long period of time, maybe like the Padres, if they start winning, do you think people just generally turn against them?
I think that's right, yeah. And I also think that, similarly, I think there's maybe too much stock placed on this sort of weird and wonderful wacky stuff. Mm. Oh yeah, well, the reason they're winning is because Joe Maddon took them to the zoo. Well, no, the reason they're winning is because they're really good. But you're right. I mean, if you look at it in other sports, it's the same, isn't it? Like, nobody likes the Patriots. Nobody likes Chelsea or Manchester United. Nobody likes Australia and cricket. It's all the same, isn't it? But you're absolutely right. They haven't even got there yet. They haven't even won anything yet. No. People hate them.
I mean, they are.
I don't hate them. I just don't like Joe Maddon.
They are admittedly storming it, but yeah, as you say, they haven't actually won anything yet.
Yeah, and the other story from yesterday evening that I just wanted to get your quick take on, because I know it's something that you're a big fan of, is the latest episode of that well-worn serial, The Ump Show, in which J.D. Martinez was ejected after the umpire, and I'm afraid I didn't write down the name of which umpire it was, asked him what he had said, and Martinez replied, "You're not having a great game," and was immediately ejected. And when asked why he was ejected, was told he was ejected for saying the same thing twice.
Right.
After being asked to repeat himself. That is a classic of the ump show genre.
That's fantastic. So he asked for an opinion, he gave an opinion, and then got ejected for it.
Yeah, what did you say? And it was, I mean, I've seen the transcript and he was incredibly polite. It wasn't like effing and swearing in his face. Anyway, I can't remember off the top of my head who the Tigers played last night. Let me just have a quick look. But whoever it was, certainly.
I'm just looking at it now because I'm trying to find it. Here we go. J.D. Martin is ejected after strikeout in six. I'm just going to watch it and see what happens. So,
oh, there's the Angels, and the Angels managed to beat the Tigers. They were already ahead, but it certainly makes the possibility of beating the Tigers somewhat easier if you manage to lose two at bats from J.D. Martinez, the most on fire hitter in baseball at present, for the weakest and stupidest reason.
So if people haven't seen it, I'll try and describe it. So pitch comes in. He then sort of walks backwards and just turns his head one way as the strike's called. As he's strolling off, umpire talks to him, asks him something. He just talks back. All he's doing is strolling and then gets ejected. There's no raised arms, there's no shouting, there's no finger pointing, nothing. He's just strolling off.
No, it's not exactly Dustin Pedroia standing his ground at chest height.
Nothing aggressive.
No. Right, so there we go. Those were the big stories in a rather quiet week in baseball. But I thought they were fun, nevertheless, and worth having a quick conversation about. So we're going to move on to the first section, which is we're going to properly introduce you, Tom. You were obviously on the last podcast, but due to technical gremlins, we managed to delete. Well, I managed to delete the section where we introduced you. So we'll do a little bit of a banter around how you got into baseball, and then I think we're going to, given that this is just you and I this week, and this is a very AL East heavy and Boston heavy lineup, we're going to have a little bit of a banter about the Red Sox season so far, I think. But we'll start with how you got into baseball.
Just try and remember what I said last time, to try and make sure I cover
it.
You
say what you want to say this time, and you don't have to repeat it.
It's very true. I could just make it all up now, couldn't I?
So
my uncle, a very long time ago, sort of early 90s, got me into the NFL. And for me, it was a case of trying to pick a team that was sensible. So I tried to look for a local team in the same sort of fashion that you usually do with football teams in the UK. And the most local team geographically and to my hometown, Tamworth, which is also in Massachusetts, was the New England Patriots. So I then straight away decided to pick the Boston Red Sox as well as my baseball team, having known nothing about baseball at all. And then sort of 2013 season, woke up in the middle of the night, struggling to sleep, went downstairs, put television on, thought, oh, baseball's on. Oh, Boston, they're my team. Who are they playing? STL? What's this? The World Series? And then, obviously, as soon as the Red Sox won the World Series, it was quite easy to start supporting them. But unfortunately, it was 2 years of bullpen and starter misery after that.
Well, yeah, I was going to talk a little bit about that bullpen, because the squads, certainly the affiliate squads anyway, for the World Baseball Classic qualifier, which is at the end of the month, which features Great Britain, were released this week. And I was quite interested and slightly perturbed, given that we'll obviously be rooting for Great Britain, to see that the Israel squad includes the Red Sox World Series 2013 winning battery of Craig Breslow and Ryan Levanway amongst their lineup. Yes.
Oh, I'll make sure I tune into those games.
Yeah, definitely. You want to see some 82 mile an hour heat being scuffled against the backboard yet again.
Is Edward Mojica involved at all? Because then we can make it a real show.
Edward Mojica's Venezuelan, right? Because the other two teams are Brazil and Pakistan. Pakistan, you will not be surprised to hear have no affiliate ball players in their squad. Probably, I assume that Trump's probably got to them when MLB were trying to bring over the Pakistan affiliate players to play in the GCL or something like that. Trump was like, nope. Anyway, so we'll move swiftly on from that. So we've established that you are a Boston Red Sox fan, and why. Are there any other players or any other teams that you like watching?
I spent a month in South California on exercise with the Air Force. And so I sort of grew a great love of San Diego Padres. Me being somebody who, I know being a Patriots and Red Sox fan doesn't really show this, but I do love an underdog as well. So I love a team that, the Padres usually don't have a chance. Last season was quite an anomaly where everyone had the whole story of they won the off season, but obviously it just turned sour pretty quickly. I do like the Padres. I enjoy watching the Mets after reading The Bad Guys One, all about the 86 Mets. I enjoy the Dodgers after reading the Boys of Summer. I just generally enjoy watching baseball. There's no real team that I dislike. I suppose I have to dislike the Yankees, but I remember writing a blog post a while ago saying that if you don't really live there, I don't think you really get the feel of it. You can sort of pretend to dislike, but I think unless you live it day in, day out, you don't really dislike them.
I think that's it, isn't it? I mean, for you and I, we weren't there in 2003, although I was watching it whilst I was at university, which gives away my age. I remember watching Aaron Boone hit that home run off Pedro at like 4 o'clock in the morning and feeling sick. That's probably because it was drunk, hilarious, wacky uni banter. So I think you're right though, but also I feel like that it isn't quite as fierce as it is in sports in the UK, particularly football, and we're going to come on to talk a bit about football in a minute. It seems much friendlier, certainly when the game that I went to when I was out there last year. I mean, admittedly, it was a Red Sox Blue Jays game, so it wasn't like it was an unfriendly setup, but everyone was just sitting together, everyone was chatting, mingling. It was a really good atmosphere. And I think because there's 162 games a year, the rivalries maybe can't be quite so fierce in some respects because of that, because it's just spread so thinly.
Yeah, I agree with that. Just talking about 2003 series, for me as well, being a baseball fan of only, 3 years now, for me it's all about trying to catch up with history. So you're talking about that Aaron Boone home run. I remember reading about it and then going to YouTube and watching it, see it happen. For me, I'm just trying to play catch up the whole time. With everything within the game. So, as I say, trying to read any of the books, any of the stories, any of the history that's gone on, I just try and keep up with it.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, it is incredibly rich, and I think we touched on this last time. It seems to be an area of sports which has attracted incredibly good writers. I think maybe unlike some of the European and British sports, it seems to attract writers from outside sports who really give it their all. You know, people like David Halberstam, who won Pulitzer Prizes for books about the military and about politics, and some of his best known books are about baseball, about basketball. That doesn't really seem to happen over here. Mm. We're going to talk about books another time, I think, actually. But could go on all day about that.
Definitely.
So we said we were going to have a bit of a Red Sox chat. So I'll start with you. How do you feel about this season? What were your expectations at the start, and do you feel like they've been met? Do you feel like this is going to be a good season? Do you feel like a transition? And are you happy with the moves that they've made in the off season and so on? Just wherever you want to take it.
I think expectations at the start were pretty high. On the pitching side, getting Carson Smith, getting Kimbrel, getting Price. I think everyone felt like, right, that's sewn up there. That's done. The pitching's done. We just need to sort our hitting. There was a lot of panic about Hanley Ramirez. There's a lot of panic about Sandoval. No one really knew what was going to happen. Pedroia, people were still a bit worried. Some people were concerned about the fact that he was breaking down a bit last year. But I think the resurgence of people like Travis Shaw sort of made people believe that, you know, maybe Shaw could take over at third, maybe he could take over at first and see what happens. So I'd probably say expectations were pretty high. There was a lot more questions about hitting than there was about pitching, certainly.
Yeah, I would say that's absolutely right. And I mean, it's kind of gone the other way in some respects. Well, certainly it did at the start of the season, where they were absolutely on heat in the hitting side of things. And, you know, Bogarts looked like the best player in baseball. Hanley looked like a really quite decent first baseman who was getting on base plenty. Betts is Betts. David Ortiz having the greatest age 40 season that anyone's ever seen. And then these other players chipping in, you know, the Chris Youngs and the Travis Shaws, the Brock Holtz were all carrying the team in the sort of bottom half of the lineup. But you know, and if anything, they were carrying the pitching. Price obviously had a really poor start. Eduardo Rodriguez got injured. Stephen Wright was carrying the pitching staff for a while. And things have kind of turned on their head, except in sort of odd occasions. If you look at the bottom half of that Red Sox hitting lineup now, it looks, with the exception of the only active Hall of Famer, Sandy Leon, it looks pretty weak. And actually, the pitching staff since the All-Star break has looked terrific, apart from one or two members of the bullpen, Junichi Tozawa, for example. So, yeah, it's been a bit of a mixed season, and it kind of feels like some of the potential's been missed, really. They seem to have been on the end of some really ridiculously stupid losses, which have been down to, like, poor base running, bizarre errors at clutch times in the game, and a lot of bad luck. There was a game in Tampa Bay a couple of nights ago where Drew Pomeranz pitched absolutely beautifully, and I have to say I'm really enjoying watching him. Whether he's quite what the Red Sox hope to see or not is another question, but he's such a nice pitcher to watch, such a lovely repeatable action, and the fact that he looks sort of like a tubby lad who can do that, it's really nice to see. But yeah, they hit 7 line drives and all of them directly at a fielder. It was just unbelievable. And the Tampa guys hit, I think they hit sequential hitting twice in the game, and both of those brought run in and Red Sox lost 2-1. And that seems to have happened, that seems to have happened quite a few times this season. So a frustrating season, but one which has shown plenty of potential for the team in the next couple of years, I think.
I think you're right on the frustrating losses, but also, I mean, you've got to throw into that as well some of John Farrell's decisions. I seem to remember a game a while back. I'm trying to remember who it was now. It might have been Rick Porcello, who was cruising, and he decided to bring him out for, and it might have been Ziegler. Can't quite remember, but I think Ziegler then immediately gave a home run away, and that was it. The game was lost. Not to blame Ziegler, I'd put it more on Farrell, and he seems to make these decisions throughout the year. He just decides to throw somebody out there or drag somebody out longer than they should be out there.
He did that last week with Porcello as well. He pitched him into the eighth inning, and they ended up giving up 2 runs when they were 3-1 up in the eighth, and lost 4-3 in the 11th on a Heath Hembree walk-off error. Yeah. I think any team can criticise their manager. I sometimes feel like some of it with Farrell is a little bit unfair, and some of it's on the players for not executing. But then, you know, he makes decisions like putting Tozawa, who looks completely done, in the eighth inning in Detroit as a setup guy when he's got Ziegler and Robbie Ross and Matt Barnes sat on the bench able to pitch. I just don't really understand that whatsoever. So do you think that... regardless of outcome this season, that it might be the end of Farrell in Boston this year?
I think it might be, and I think there's been times during the year where the pressure's really been. I know the Boston fans are some of the worst for overreacting, especially on Twitter. But I think a lot of the pressure that's been put on him this year for some of the silly decisions. I think it's horrible to say, but I think the cancer scare last year really sort of saved his job more than anything, because I don't think the club could turn around and fire him at that point. I think he was on his way out, and that coming along, I think, really saved his job. But I agree on the sense about the players as well. There was a lot of push during the trade deadline where people were demanding more hitters, they were demanding more pitchers. But as you said, at the start of the season, the team already proved they could hit, and they've continued it. I mean, they're still first in average, still first in RBIs, runs. They're still first in a lot of good categories for hitting. So they're still up there and still doing it and proving they can do it. I think it's almost like the old days of the 90s and early 2000 Brazil football team of we'll just score more than you, and that's what they've got a hope on.
Yeah, but the problem is at the moment that they're getting really good pitching and they're not scoring more than you when more is 3 instead of 2. And I think a lot of that is down to that lower half of the order. Shaw just looks like he's forgotten how to hit a ball. Bradley, he's hitting a few home runs, but he's not hitting anything else. Bogarts is just... He looks like a dog chasing his tail often when he's in his at-bats at the moment, Bogarts, which is just bizarre because he looked like he was going to hit absolutely everything that was thrown at him for the first half of the season. And he looks like he's tired, I think. So I think... at least one of those three needs to pick up the slack, because, you know, Sandy Leone, the only active Hall of Famer, is not going to keep up this crazy streak for the rest of the year. Pedroia is absolutely playing absolutely out of his mind at the moment as well. So, you know, I think they're going to get to the playoffs. It's going to be nip and tuck as to whether it's Boston or Toronto who wins the wins the division now. I actually think the Yankees are going to finish above the Orioles. I think they're sunk now. But yeah, lots of potential. But it'll be interesting to see how they cope without the big man next year, without David Ortiz.
Yeah, there's a lot of chat of Encarnacion coming along to the Red Sox. I mean, Ortiz has already endorsed his move to the Red Sox to happen. So it should be interesting. We've obviously got quite a few hitters coming up at the moment, especially with Moncada looking well as well in Double A. But just to go back to JBJ that you mentioned, I thought I'd read this the other day and I couldn't believe it, but he's hitting 167 in August.
Yeah, what 167 in August with about six home runs, which is bizarre.
Yeah, it's so strange. And like you say, I mean, I remember midway through the season that Bogaerts actually said to the press, "I am tired, I need a rest." And there was just no one to put in there to replace him. I think it was the time when Holt was going through all his concussion problems and head problems. Mm. And I think he was just desperate for a rest, and I just don't think he's had that.
He still doesn't seem to have had it yet either. Yeah. I mean, I know that Aaron Hill hasn't quite carried his Minnesota form over to Boston. Shaw's struggling. But he's got Holt back in that utility role now that Chris Young's fit, and obviously Benintendi was up and rolling. But the fact that Bogaerts has had so few days off, I think might come back to haunt Boston in September and October.
Agreed.
Anyway, so yeah, that's it. That's the Red Sox. Certainly plenty more storylines to play out there. Not least, I think, who comes up in September, whether we do see Moncada or whether we do see some of these interesting pitchers. Indeed, the return of Cy Kelly himself, the Cy Young of Pawtucket, Joe Kelly. I think he'll be back. And yeah, the other interesting storyline on the Red Sox before we move on entirely is, who's this Clay Buchholz guy? Who's he? He looks quite good.
I know. Where's he come from? He's quite handy in the last few starts, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's typical Clay, isn't it? You toss a coin and that's what's going to happen. You either get horrible, horrible outing with runs everywhere or incredible strikeouts. You just don't know what to do with him.
I thought there was a really interesting observation from Brian McPherson from the Providence Journal last week, though, that it doesn't really make any sense to take Buchholz out of the rotation at this point, because when Buchholz is rolling, the only thing that really stops it is injury. I mean, you know it's going to come sooner rather than later, but you may as well ride him giving you six and a half, seven innings of 10 strikeout baseball whilst you've got it. It didn't really make sense to me that he got sent down to do the high leverage stuff in the rotation in the bullpen when he was genuinely looked like the number two that he can be at the top end of his potential.
Yeah,
we'll see. I'm sure that one hasn't completely played out, because I still am a little bit worried about Eduardo Rodriguez's knee and Stephen Wright's durability.
Do you think Erod's come back? Sorry, I just said Erod then. I really shouldn't say that. Do you think Eduardo Rodriguez has come back a bit too early?
What, from his injury at the start of the season?
Yeah, you see, I don't know if he was rushed back, but it seemed pretty quick for him getting back.
I think he definitely was rushed back the first time. I think he didn't look right at all. And the team at that time was just desperate for pitching. That was when Buchholz looked like an absolute junk ball pitcher, and really the only pitcher that looked any good whatsoever at that time was Wright, with Porcello looking at that time like a solid three rather than the low one that he's pitched as from sort of May-June time. Yeah, he was definitely rushed back. The second time out, he looked really good, but clearly he's still feeling, side effects of that knee injury. Mm. We'll see. I still think there's question marks over that rotation, but I think Pomeranz has been a real stabilizing influence, and Price obviously now is beginning to look like David Price, although not quite the David Price that we've all known for the last couple of years. So maybe we'll see him before the end of the season. That would be nice.
It would be good just to try and shore up a bit of that rotation, as you say. Especially Wright had a bit of a nightmare the other night, didn't he? I don't know what the conditions were like. There's a lot of chat of if it's what, moist, wet, damp, too sunny, then the knuckleball doesn't really work.
Yeah, he is a sweaty man. It was the first inning. The first inning got away from him, which it has on occasion. And it was his first inning back pitching for a month, and he let two knucklers go that didn't knuckle, and they got sent over the monster. And then he pitched pretty well, but by that point, the Red Sox were in a hole. And then Tozawa gave up his trademark bomb to Junichi, put him out of his misery. And on that note, let's move on. So we were going to talk about a couple of interesting comparisons between baseball and our national pastime, football, or soccer, for those of you listening in America. We do bill this podcast as a British take on baseball, and to date we've been pretty neglectful of anything really British at all. But we're gonna remedy that this week, not least through this conversation. I thought there was a couple of interesting stories this week that I picked up in various places that were to do with football that immediately made me start thinking about how these things would be handled in baseball and to think about some of the parallels. So one was the story about the Burnley player, Andre Gray, and the FA misconduct charge against him for some tweets from several years ago. So we'll talk about that one first, I think. And the other one is to do with the use of data analysis at Fulham, which is obviously a huge thing in baseball and in all American sports, starting to seep its way into British sports and into football. But really, some bizarre public statements about this. So we'll talk about that secondly. So we'll start with Andre Gray. And for those of you either listening in America or who are in the UK and haven't heard about this story, Andre Gray is a footballer, a striker who plays for Burnley in the Premier League. He was their star player last year as they were promoted to the Premier League from the Championship, which is the second division. He scored an awful lot of goals for them last year, and he scored his first Premier League goal last weekend against the Boston Red Sox John Henry owned Liverpool Football Club in a 1-0 win for Burnley at Anfield, which was itself a really big surprise result and a really good result for Burnley. So Gray has only recently made the top tier of football, much like Jamie Vardy last year. He's a player who's had a great deal of success lower down the pyramid and in non-league, which is sort of the semi-professional indie ball equivalent in baseball. He scored a lot of goals there, then scored a lot of goals for Luton Town and Brentford in the sort of minor league equivalents of British football, and got his big break with Burnley. So the controversy surrounding Gray is that after his goal at Liverpool last week, somebody managed to surface some tweets from 4 years ago when he was playing for Hinkley United, who play at a very, very low tier of English non-league football, in which he made some really quite unsavoury remarks about gay people. I won't repeat them because they were really vile, and there were several of them, one of which was particularly disgusting. And he's been charged by the English Football Association with historic misconduct, which is something of a sort of legal fiction in terms of catching up on him. He hasn't had his hearing yet, but he's almost certainly going to have the book thrown at him. He's apologised for it, says he doesn't think that anymore, but he's probably going to get some form of suspension. And it immediately brought to my mind how this would have been handled in baseball. And I thought that the best comparison was with some of the domestic violence cases that we've seen in baseball, particularly around Aroldis Chapman and Jose Reyes, and how even in the Chapman case, where there was no conviction, no charges brought against Chapman, and he still got a 30-game ban. Reyes obviously got an 80-game ban for his. And yeah, I wondered what your take on that was, Tom. Whether baseball is a sport where there's more pressure put on the players to be role models. Whether there's something about American society that demands that there's more of a sort of public trial of them. And because Gray's Gray's incident is unusual. Like, I think that was what was so interesting about it, was that it was a situation where the Football Association had stepped in and really tried to draw a line in the sand. But it sort of feels like they're a couple of years behind MLB on that. And I don't know what your take on that would be.
I think first off, obviously, these are two completely different situations. Domestic violence getting banned for 80 games compared to homophobic tweets from, what was it, 4 years ago. That's not to say, you know, that the tweets are fine. That's not the case at all. It's an odd situation because they're obviously going to charge him for stuff that happened 4 years ago before he was even a professional. And it's going to be quite a difficult one because in my mind, you just think, well, how can you prove that you still believe this or you still think this and then ban somebody? It's a real difficult one. I mean, the guy was playing non-league football, but I think everyone in non-league football has a dream to eventually go on and play Premiership football. Otherwise, you wouldn't be there. What's the point? And if you want to go on and play Premiership football, then you need to start acting like a Premiership footballer from early days. And I don't mean flash cars and nice women. I mean to have that public persona that is untouchable. Because things like this will happen. If this is a statement that's made in a pub between friends, it's never going to stay live, is it? But if you put it on Twitter or put it on Facebook or whatever, it's there forever. People will always be able to find it unless you delete it as soon as you say it. So I think it's a difficult one. I mean, in his statement, he says that you know, his life has changed and he's a different person then. And that's, do you know what? That's completely understandable and believable. I went to Australia in 2003 and I was demanding that, well, I say demanding, I was quite adamant that I should have an English passport rather than a British passport, because that was my mindset at the time. It was a silly mindset looking back, but I was quite insular in the fact that I was brought up in a small town just outside the Midlands and that's all I knew. And as soon as I joined the Air Force, it was a case that I could go and experience things, different people, different cultures, different countries. And I realised how fantastic the world actually is. And, you know, maybe this has happened to him. Maybe he's rise to the Premier League. He's developed different opinions, different experiences from what's happened. That's in no way whatsoever condoning what's been supporting what he'd said on Twitter. It was a stupid thing to say. But unfortunately, it's been pulled up. And I think it's going to be a very difficult one if the FA charge him for 10 games. That seems like a huge amount. Such a short season of, what is it, 36, 38 games or something. That seems like a lot for something that happened 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think I agree with you about that. But I was wondering if there were any examples of this happening in US at all. And I did manage to find one, and that was Yunel Escobar, the now Los Angeles Angels infielder, 3-4 years ago was banned for 3 games for wearing a homophobic statement on his eye black. 3 games. So comparatively, and that was in public, in a game, on the television. And that to me seems like a rather worse misdemeanor than the one that Gray did 4 years ago. And he wasn't to know that this was going to get dug up by a few people. And so maybe I'm saying here that on on DV, MLB are way out ahead of the Football Association, but maybe on homophobia they're way behind.
I suppose in that sense, as you said, though, it was public. It was in a game. He was in the majors at that point. So I think it's very difficult to go back to somebody's non-league days and pick that up. But as I said in the first place, you know, if you are in non-league, you want to be a professional footballer at the end of the day. So you've got to start acting like one from an early stage. You can't be saying things like this out in public on Twitter. It's just ridiculous. And I think anything that does go out on Twitter and then get found, we've seen it before where, most recently actually, where NFL players are getting, or NBA players are getting drafted, and people search through their timeline and find tweets from, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. I think there was a guy who got drafted for the Lakers who had about 3 or 4 tweets where he was gobbing off about Kobe and the Lakers and how much he can't stand LA. And you just think, okay, he may have thought that 5 years ago, but obviously he's been drafted by them now. He's not going to be thinking that immediately. So should he be charged in the same fashion? But the public just get up in quite a big sort of anger about it all, and they demand justice there and then. But, you know, where do you draw the line for people? How far back are we going to go?
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the guy. You'll know because you're a much bigger Gridiron fan than I am. What was the name of the chap who the Rams drafted, who'd written some rather spicy tweets about Yasiel Puig, which turned out to be quite right, to be honest. But there was a photo shoot of he and Puig making up. but maybe they're not friends anymore.
It was Jared Goff who
Jared Goff, that's him.
Yeah, and they, I can't remember who put that about Puig, but yeah, again, he, you know, in the moment, it's one of those things, isn't it? I imagine if I ever met Jonathan Papelbon, I'd you know, shake his hand and try and be his best friend, even though I've gobbled up about him enough times on Twitter and in public.
I just to sort of bring it back to that that DV point. I wonder if the reason that we haven't seen such censure and scorn poured on that in the UK is that we just haven't seen anything comparable to the Chapman and Reyes and the Greg Hardy situations in the UK for such a long time. I think the only really comparable one that I can think of is Gazza, and that was, you know, 20 years ago now. But I wonder if we had a Gazza, bit someone behaving like Gazza did towards his wife Cheryl these days, if you might see a similar situation.
I think you would. I think there'd be huge public backlash on it. But like you say, we haven't seen it for 20 years, and that's not to say it was acceptable back then. Maybe just, you know, it was happening, but we didn't know about it. I think if people can pick up on it, especially if it gets picked up on Twitter and Facebook, people just run with it, and they get so angry so quickly, and they demand the punishment. We saw it with Ray Rice in the NFL. Initially, yeah, it was just a little bit of video footage, and people were, you know, what was happening in the lift? What was going on in there? And then as soon as the full footage came out, there was pure uproar, and they demanded his head there and then.
Yeah, that was going to bring me on to maybe like the last question in this point. That I kind of had a bit of a theory and wondered if the reason why they make such a big deal of this in the States, and rightly so, is that they do have a media which sort of seeks it out and holds people's feet to the fire. You know, people like Katie Nolan with Greg Hardy, some of the stuff on Deadspin and ESPNW about some of the other DV issues. There really is a media sort of commentariat who really go for these things and try and get into them, so, which we don't, you know, the sports commentariat in the UK, they're talking about, you know, Roy Hodgson's tactics not being very good and Mourinho being hilarious, and that's pretty much it. They're not really issues based, are they? Which, that maybe there's just more space to be like that in the US with so many more TV channels, so many more sports talk radio shows, and so on.
Yeah, maybe they've got to find that story that's going to sell the papers. Like you say, I think I'm trying to think of the last, apart from Beckham, who is the Beckham and Rooney, maybe is the last major footballers who were, you know, private life and also sports life were all over the newspapers. I'll be honest, I haven't followed football since about 2008, 2009 now. I just sort of switched off from it and departed myself from the game. But obviously, I still keep in touch with the news and what's going on in the world. And I can't remember the last time that somebody filled the front pages like Beckham and Rooney have compared to modern day footballers. Maybe we just don't have that, like you say, in the UK, the amount of news agencies that want to get involved and get all these news stories and dig deep and find these tweets and do all of that.
I think the only one that I could think of recently is possibly Raheem Sterling, who seems to be a complete scapegoat for certain parts of the UK media. You know, he clearly didn't play very well in the last tournament, and he's a bit of a petulant brat sometimes, but he's a very talented player who earns a lot of money. He's done some slightly daft things, like, you know, inhaling nitrous oxide on a night out, and certain parts of the UK media seem to want to scapegoat him for being a young lad who has a good time and occasionally doesn't play very well for his football team, which, that's the sort of petty and pathetic stuff that our media seems to focus on, whereas in America maybe they're a little bit more you know, a little bit more focused on real issues rather than this sort of slightly pathetic baiting of young guys who are just good at something that they get paid a lot of money for.
Yeah. Do you think the media over this side are a little bit scared to dig that deep as well? When you look at Gorka and Hulk Hogan, what happened there, and the fact that they're now shut down, they're done, they're finished.
Yeah.
Do you think there's also that little bit of pressure of, you know, if you haven't got hard evidence, you're not absolutely sure, you don't know how it's going to go, you just don't publish it at all. Whereas, I don't know, maybe in American media, I find that they're quite happy to publish stuff and just go for it.
Maybe it's going to go the other way. Maybe Peter Thiel and Hulk Hogan are going to make the American media a little more timid. I guess watch this space. Yeah, so an interesting one, and we'll see what happens to Andre Gray. Maybe we can revisit this conversation when his punishment is handed down by the FA. But I just thought there were some interesting comparisons in terms of the way the media operates, the way that the administrations operate. So we should have a bit of a chat about it. The other area, just to move the conversation on, was surrounding the use of data analysis in sport. And specifically, I wanted to talk about an article by Sam Wallace from the Daily Telegraph newspaper about Fulham FC. So for those of you who are listening in the States, Fulham are a team that play in the second tier of English football. They were in the Premier League for a long time, but they're not doing so well at the moment. They were owned by Shahid Khan, who also owns the Jacksonville Jaguars. They have instituted some quite deep use of data in terms of their player analysis, player development, recruiting, all at the behest of Khan's son, Tony Khan, who runs the football club, and a friend and colleague of his who's the head of player recruitment at Fulham called Craig Klein. You can find Sam Wallace's article online. I'll link to it from our Twitter as well. It's absolutely weird, and I think utterly reminiscent of where we are, particularly in public perception of use of data analysis in sports in the UK. So what becomes apparent is that Craig Klein does seem like a bit of a prat, but some of the things he's doing actually seem really sensible. So he's at a bit of an impasse with the manager or the coach of Fulham. He's a chap called Slavisa Jokanovic, and this has sort of come to a head around the recruitment of a player called Andreas Pereira, who is on the books of Manchester United, who Jokanovic wanted to sign, but Klein didn't. And the reason that he didn't was, and this is a phrase used throughout Sam Wallace's piece, so Pereira didn't have, and this is actually written throughout the piece in inverted commas, he didn't have both boxes checked. And it immediately made me think of, you know, Dr. Evil in Austin Powers with his laser beam where he does the air quotes, and that it was a really, really sarcastic, and it's used throughout. Now, the reason that Pereira didn't have both boxes checked is because he's a youth player and there's not a lot of data on youth football in the UK, so it's really difficult to analyse them from that point of view. So in that respect, it does highlight the shortcomings of data analysis in British sport, particularly in football. There's not data on everyone. There's not a lot of data on a lot of players. The analysis is notoriously difficult because it's not broken down into chunks as baseball is. You know, someone isn't coming up for a single at-bat where there's three true outcomes. It's a much more fluid game and therefore quite difficult to analyse on the hoof. And some of it is very contingent on the quality of the person recording the data, which is, if I'm led to believe correctly, quite mixed. So there's some problems in it. You can see why someone like Slavisa Jokanovic might, who's a bit of a greybeard, has been around the sport for a long, long time, might have some question marks about it. But I thought the overall tone of that article, particularly the use of this, the seeming like just incredulity about this both boxes checked, so someone is both liked by scouts and liked by the data, which is just absolutely basic level stuff in baseball and indeed in basketball and football, American football, that is. I just couldn't get over the tone of it. I don't know what you thought, Tom.
Yeah, as you said, it's a very strange article, and not because of the way it's written, I don't think. I think it's just the information that comes out of it. I mean, the stuff about Pereira and the fact that they didn't have enough data on him. Well, to be fair, to guys when they're getting drafted in baseball, there's not a huge amount of data. They're basing it on maybe high school a little bit and the main college stats if they've gone to college. But it's all about projections from then on. So surely, they, you know, if the stats are looking good so far on Pereira and the projections are good from the scouts, then yeah, you take a punt on him, don't you? That's the idea. But the fact that it's just hard and fast, it almost seems like very basic Moneyball type stuff where, you know, it's does he score more than 2 goals per game? No, well, we're not signing him, or whatever it may be for them.
Suggesting that maybe the problem really is that Craig Klein isn't quite as clever as he thinks he is.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe he's just trying to bring Moneyball. He's read the book and he's, you know, he may be a very qualified guy for stats analysis, that side of things. But as you've already said, football is so fluid in its nature. It's very difficult to just say, you know, oh, this guy is very good at long shots, he's very good at short shots. As soon as that ball touches his feet and he passes it, there's so many outcomes that could happen. And as you said, it's very subjective of how you determine whether it's a successful pass or not. If the ball reaches the other guy but it bobbles off the guy's knee, is that an unsuccessful pass? You know, you've got to make that subjective decision on what it is. And I don't think, I kind of like the idea of analytics coming into football, but I just don't, I think it's still more about scouting on that side of things. It's very difficult to bring it into this.
But do you not think that the scouting would be more informed if they did have at least, you know, some sort of data pack before they went and looked at the players and were able to see if they matched up to what they were watching?
I can kind of see that two ways. We do it certainly with instructing at work. There's two methods of thought. Do you read the person's previous reports before you go flying with them, or do you just go flying with them and then go back and look at their reports? So do you go in with a completely clear mind, or do you go in with a bias of one side or the other? It's difficult in that sense. I suppose when you're making a business decision like this, you want all the information. So I would imagine they would have to have the stats to back it up before they go into the scouting process. But, I mean, as you've already said, they're behind baseball. I think most sports are going to be behind baseball at the moment for what they know and can achieve. I think there is a place in it for football, but I don't think it's as solid as it is in baseball. I mean, it talks in the article about the fact that Klein doesn't even get to the games, does he? He ends up just watching the stats and checking those out. And I think there's so much more to it than just that.
But I guess that if you look at some of the people who've been incredibly successful in baseball, so, you know, Bill James, maybe not the best example, but someone like Andrew Friedman, you know, he's not a baseball guy. He's a markets guy. He makes decisions based on data. Now, he's not stupid enough to not pay attention to his scouts and not bring in, you know, some considered and subjective opinion. But, you know, he's a guy who made an awful lot of decisions in Tampa Bay based on data, and, you know, it worked. So why can't it work for someone like Craig Klein?
I struggle to argue with that. Football, like all other sports, is going to be copycat. So if they do it and it works, then plenty of others are going to follow them. I really do feel that the game is just, it's too fluid. There's too many outcomes that could happen. I think to an extent, American football, they may have the stats, but I don't think it's that driven by stats. Again, because it's so fluid, there's so many outcomes that can happen.
The other thing about American football is it's so stop-start as well. And I think where the stats come in there is potentially on things like percentage plays. You know, if we do this play in this situation, then 7 times out of 10, we're going to make the 5 yards that we need for a first down. Whereas, you know, a coach, just by the nature of football, cannot do that. It doesn't lend itself to it.
I suppose when it does, though, it's things like free kicks and corners, throw-ins.
Yeah.
situations like that, like you say, when it's stop start and you can say, right, if we pile people on this side, we're more likely to get the ball.
Yeah. The other question I had around this was, I wonder if it's really like a public knowledge and a slight sort of stuck in the ways issue as opposed to a club one. I mean, you do read reports occasionally. I mean, obviously clubs are quite secretive about their proprietary information and their intellectual property, but you do read reports about certain clubs. I think Everton was one under David Moyes, and certainly Sam Allardyce, the New England manager, has got a reputation for being big on the data, particularly around fitness, around stamina and things like that. There's a lot of third-party businesses, so people like Opta, Y-Scout, which is a sort of online platform where you can scout all sorts of players from all over the world and get all their stats and things. Who Scored is another one where it's very, very stats focused, and you see a lot of their articles now on different football websites and on club websites. So I wonder if the clubs are actually doing a lot more of this than we give them credit for, but it's just not a public thing. And the only time it does seem to come into the public eye is where there's a bit of a conflict, as there has been at Fulham. So maybe that's it. Maybe it just hasn't crossed that Rubicon like Sabermetrics has, where it just becomes sort of the orthodoxy, and that will come in time.
I think, like you said, if we think about it in baseball, what are the sexy stats? Well, the sexy stats are things like slugging percentage, things like OPS, things that you can quantify and make sense of. But as you said, Roy Hodgson's looking at stamina and fitness. That's not really a sexy stat to put in the back of a newspaper, is it? You think of things like Team Sky as well, where they're looking at sleep quality. They're looking at amount of sleep people are getting and how that makes a difference in their performance. The marginal gain side of things. So them taking, the riders taking their own pillows and blankets with them whenever they go to a hotel on the Tour de France. So they get that 1% extra of comfort compared to normal. And again, it's all not sexy, is it? You can't sell a player on, well, he gets really good quality sleep. I can't imagine he's going to draw a 10 million plus transfer fee for just his quality of sleep. You know,
I wonder if maybe that's it. Maybe we just need that, well, or football just needs that one stat, you know, the equivalent of OPS, which obviously is old hat now, but 15 years ago was, you know, the big thing. That's how that's how Billy Beane picked his players, how many were on base percentage. I think the one thing that you're sort of starting to see discussion of a little bit is something called expected goals. I don't know if you've heard of that.
No, I've not.
So expected goals is, it is exactly what it says. It's how many goals you'd expect a given team to score based on the number of chances in certain quadrants of the pitch. So obviously, there's less expectation that you'll score a goal from a 30-yard shot than there is if someone crosses it and you prod one wide from 4 yards. And there's a lot of metrics around it. You know, the more crosses you put in, the more dribbles you do into the box, the more shots you have from 10 yards and so on and so on. And it comes out with an expected goals number. There's a website called Experimental 361 that does some really interesting analysis of this in the lower reaches of the Football League. But yeah, that stuff is starting to crop up a little bit in common football speak, I think. Like, for example, yeah, the expected goals for Manchester United against Hull yesterday might have been 3, but they only scored 1, and that shows they were dominant, etc. And it's rather than just how many shots did you have or how many corners did you have, which you might have counted previously and shown dominance. Yeah, so that might be the one. That might be the one that starts people thinking a little bit more statistically.
No, it does sound good. Almost in a sort of war sense as well, isn't it? I don't know how they could quantify that within football, but could you have wins above replacement for football? Because a lot of times, you know, it's going to be, is it this guy or this guy? But I suppose, again, with football, with it being so fluid, you know, a different centre midfielder might make the difference in one game because he's going up against another guy, but then another game it's a completely different setup, and you don't necessarily need the best guy, you need the strongest guy in that second game. But I don't know, it's a difficult one. I think the expected goal stuff certainly sounds like a step forward for the game when you're talking about analytics and sabermetrics side of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question about war. I mean, that would be the best way of doing it. You know, we need some boffin to come up with that, because you can look at a player like Paul Pogba and go, right, well, the reason that he's so good subjectively is because he can do everything, right? He can score goals from wherever he is on the pitch. He's incredibly fit. He can also defend, and he can turn defence into attack. You know, he's like the Mike Trout of football, and that's why Man United have just paid 100 million quid for him. But it would be really nice to say Paul Pogba is worth 11 war, which he probably is, but somebody needs to be able to quantify that. That's an interesting point, that, Tom. Maybe someone who's a little bit more mathematically minded than us, who's following the podcast or following the Twitter feed, can take up that challenge.
Anything above GCSE maths means you're more more mathematically minded than me.
Yeah, and me too. Maybe one or two of my friends and contemporaries from school. One of whom is a mathematics professor at Cambridge University. I might get in touch with him. Sadly, we're not in touch anymore. But maybe I can send him that conundrum. Well, the other thing I was going to touch on briefly, and I sort of touched on it in terms of public perception, was whether it's just that we've got in football a lot of old school commentators who maybe would just laugh this off. This is intellectual crap. I know all about football. So I wondered maybe if what we need, and you know, notwithstanding your really good suggestion of a war for football, do we need a fire Joe Morgan moment in football? Do we need a purge of the anti-intellectual commentators who just think sabermetrics is a lot of old rubbish and who wouldn't get you start? And I wonder, I mean, I know you said you haven't been following football closely for a few years, but who would the Joe Morgan be in soccer?
I initially thought John Motson, but then I actually, thinking back, I remember him actually firing a load of stats out when he was talking about football. I don't know, maybe sort of the old school pundits. I don't know if he's still doing it, but Rodney Marsh used to be very much an old school type scout, wasn't he? He would always talk about personality of players and things like that.
He's got a lot of passion and a lot of ticker.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, do you know what? You make a good point about the fact that I could imagine a commentator coming in and using a lot of stats and talking about, I don't know if they do, because like I say, I haven't watched it for a very long time, but if you started throwing stats at the average fan, would they be sitting there going, what the hell is this all about? Why am I listening to this? I don't really understand it.
I had a couple of suggestions. Mark Lawrenson would be well up there as a very sour man who just likes making very bad puns, and if you mentioned a stat to him, I imagine would try and turn it into a terrible joke that you would be embarrassed if your dad told. Yeah. Harry Redknapp, just because I can't stand him. I think actually I would just quite like it to be Harry Redknapp. Or Robbie Savage, maybe. He was just grim, and he is the type of person who just talks about, you know, he's got good hair, therefore he's good at football. Maybe him.
The only things I do notice about football these days, especially on Twitter, is that people love Gary Neville commentating and people can't stand Michael Owen commentating. So maybe Michael Owen could pick up the mantle and take over this new stat revolution, and he could start pushing that as his brand.
But the reason that people love Gary Neville is because he does do sort of stats-based analysis. He talks about people's position on the pitch and how that leads to more opportunities for the other team to score and so on. So there you go. Maybe the worm is turning. Maybe that's it. Maybe Gary Neville's going to be the poster boy for the statistical revolution. And Michael Owen genuinely should just be put out to pasture, bless him. So that's it. That's where we're going. We are not going to be as negative as Fire Joe Morgan. We're going to be pro Gary Neville in terms of the football and statistics revolution. I'll give him a call. I'm sure he'll be happy to hear from us. Right. So I think that's it. I think that's all we've got time for this week. So thanks, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you. Appreciate it.
No problem. And before we go, we do have a few parish notices. So you can find us on Twitter. The Twitter for the podcast and for the blog is @batflips_nerds. You can find the blog, which is going to have some new content this week. We've got a really excellent piece on pitch framing to go up there this week. It's www.batflipsandnerds.wordpress.com, and you can find our podcast archive on SoundCloud, and we are going to put the podcast on iTunes this week, come hell or high water. So if you download us from iTunes, please give us a review, please give us 5 stars, it really helps people see it. Please leave a comment, please tell your friends about the podcast if you think it's something that they'd like. That'd be really, really kind of you. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Epouvantail. That's Epouvantail. It's French for scarecrow if you want to look it up. And Tom, where are you on Twitter?
I'm at Pedroia's Face, as in Dustin Pedroia. So at Pedroia's Face. We really need to attack this, where your Twitter handle came from. We need to find that out, why it happened.
Maybe next time. That's it. That's all we've got time for. We've got a really special episode lined up for next week. We hope. More on that later in the week, once it's in the can. But suffice to say, it should be a really interesting thing for you to listen to. And as I threatened earlier, it will be very British-based. So look forward to that. But in the meantime, thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.